Welcome to the Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. This week, we're diverging from our normal Odd Years format to introduce you to another Cook Political Report product, the Editor's Roundtable. This podcast features a rotating cast of our Cook Political Report team, breaking down the latest news, analysis, and insights about the most important House, Senate, and gubernatorial contests in the country. We like to think of this podcast as an opportunity for you to get the behind-the-scenes access to conversations we're having at our weekly Cook Political Report editorial meetings. This week, my talented colleagues talk about the most interesting and consequential state in the 2026 midterms, Michigan. The Wolverine State, it has it all. A three-way governor's race featuring the former Democratic mayor of Detroit, who is now running as an independent, competitive primaries for one of the most competitive Senate races in the country, and a slew of critical House contests that could determine control of Congress next year. And can't have a conversation about Michigan without using a mitt. In this case, our managing editor's own oven mitt to help illustrate where each important congressional district and where those key cities in the state are located. By the way, that U shape between the thumb and index finger, that's Detroit, by the way. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and more importantly, if you do like it, and to hear more of it, subscribe to the Cook Political Report, where you can get the kind of deeply sourced, nonpartisan, and accurate analysis of every race in the 2025 and 2026 cycle. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. You can also get Editor's Roundtable on Apple Podcasts. It's just $1.99 a month. What a bargain. All right, here we go. On with the show.
Hey, everyone. I'm Carrie Dan. I'm the managing editor of the Cook Political Report, and this is the Editor's Roundtable brought to you by the Cook Political Report. Today, I'm excited to be joined by my colleagues Jessica Taylor and Aaron Covey. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey, Carrie. How you doing?
Just great. And a reason that I'm doing so well is that we get to talk today about Michigan. This week, we went really deep on Michigan at the Cook Political Report. Both Aaron and Jess wrote about it. We're going to walk you through all of it. Because for some people, Michigan is on the brain because it's this beautiful vacation destination in the summer. Some people may be thinking about college football looming in the fall. We are thinking about Michigan all day, every day, because it is the center of the political universe, and it is starting now, going to the midterms and beyond. So why is that? We'll talk about the Wolverine State and all of the interesting storylines on the Democratic and the Republican side. You should definitely check out both Jess and Aaron's stories on cookpolitical.com, but we are going to walk you through some of it today. So Jess, let's start with you. You wrote this week about the GOP Senate primary in Michigan, where there's a strange thing going on where there is a conservative Republican who's getting some feedback from Trump allies saying, hey, maybe don't run, and he does not seem to really care. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so you mentioned Michigan sort of being the center of the political universe. I mean, this was a top Senate race last time where you saw former Congressman Mike Rogers lose to Alyssa Slotkin by about 19,000 votes. He came the closest anyone had since 2000. We had sort of the surprise retirement earlier this year of Gary Peters opening up the seat. Republicans really feel like in 2024, that, you know, Slotkin had basically a clear primary challenge while Rogers was still sort of fending off a self-funder who aired ads against him. And remember, this is an August primary, so it's very late. It doesn't allow for a lot of turnaround for the general election. And they feel like this time, if they can clear the field effectively for Rogers, because there's not, Slotkin had a coronation, and that's not happening on the Democratic side this time. You have Congresswoman Haley Stevens that's in, health official Abdul Al-Sayed, you have Joe Tate, the former Speaker of the House, and you have State Senator Mallory McMorrow, and they're all sort of fighting for different parts of the Democratic ideology, and that's a whole, we could have a whole discussion in itself of this, of the Democratic race, but we focused on the Republican side this week because even though, you know, as soon as Rogers announced he was running again in April, NRSC Chairman Tim Scott, Senate Republican leader John Thune came out with a statement supporting him. He has more than 20 other senators endorsing him. He came out with two House members from Michigan endorsing him. And perhaps most importantly, he has sort of the tacit blessing of Trump in Chris LaCivita, his former campaign co-chair and manager. And then bolster Tony Fabrizio is working for another super PAC that's backing him. So, you know, there have been, when I was talking with sources, it's like, we have made very clear to Bill Huizenga, who wants to run here, that, you know, you're not welcome, basically one source said. You know, you are going to face this because, like I said, they don't want this primary. And I think the question to me is, and I think we don't fully know this yet, is Huizenga sort of going to be, could he actually hurt Rogers in that regard? Or is he sort of more of a nuisance in a way that, you know, he gets in, he doesn't really get any traction. Now, the president has not officially endorsed in this race. I think it probably is that he hasn't made many endorsements yet because he still needs these people's votes, especially Huizenga, that's still in Congress for, you know, the one big beautiful bill and different things. But it's really interesting because you have Huizenga putting out, you know, I got a hold of a fundraising letter that he put out. You know, Rogers was not, when he came back to run, he'd left office right after sort of the Obama years and things, and he was sort of a Bush-era Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, former FBI director. He'd been critical of Trump, especially after 2020 and the election denialism and different things. And so it was sort of an uneasy, somewhat conversion to MAGAism for Rogers last time. I mean, he's all on board now, and he's had fealty to the president. But Huizenga is arguing, listen, he underperformed the president, so we can't make that same mistake again. I mean, drop-off is not uncommon in these Senate races. We saw it across the board. And this is the challenge that Republicans are going to have in getting voters for President Trump back to the polls when he's not on the rolls there. And so he's sort of arguing, I'm a better ambassador of the MAGA brand and can bring out these voters better, versus Rogers is saying, you know, I've already done all this work in the state. He's effectively been running for 2 years now. I mean, Rogers was not a good fundraiser last time, and that's what really hurt him against Slotkin. I'm watching to see these FEC reports coming out middle of July. Is Rogers going to do better this time? You know, Michigan was not among the top tier Senate races until sort of the very end, because you had Montana, you had Ohio above it, and different things. So it wasn't necessary to a Senate majority. Republicans now view it as sort of it's perhaps their best pickup opportunity, at least after Georgia, or even, you know, some Republicans I talked to in Michigan argued we're a better pickup opportunity than Georgia because Brian Kemp is not running down there. They have a messy primary of their own versus, you know, we're an open seat. It's easier to win an open seat than it is against an incumbent. So, you know, Huizenga, though, he's on the House Financial Services Committee, so he has access to a lot of money, and, you know, he can fundraise for his House seat theoretically and can convert that to a Senate seat. So has he gotten big donations from people, even as he's sort of testing the waters for the Senate race? And, you know, I feel like they've thrown out everything they can to, like, show him, like, you don't do this. But, you know, I feel like short of a Trump endorsement telling him not to, I'm not sure what else they can do, because we saw this last cycle that, you know, for instance, in Montana, Matt Rosendale was going to run. And even though, you know, other people like LaCivita had lined up behind Tim Sheehy and different things, and he got in the race, but then when Trump endorsed, he withdrew again. So is that something we could see happen again? And I think this sort of segues well into Aaron's piece, of course, because one of the reasons that they are arguing that Huizenga should not run is because he represents an increasingly competitive House district. So there is a push to get some of these members, Republican members, Trump has said this, to run instead of running for higher office, to run for these seats in what, of course, is shaping up to be a difficult midterm cycle, especially in the House.
So that is a great segue to Aaron. You know a lot about Bill Huizenga and his district. It's one that Democrats are rooting for him to run, both for some chaos on the Republican side and also to maybe give them an opportunity to pick up that seat. Go through it.
Yeah, so this is a House district that has not been competitive in recent history. And so a lot of parties kind of saw it as a potential reach opportunity for Democrats previously, but this might be the cycle that it really comes online. And that's partially because it might be open, with Huizenga looking seriously at a Senate campaign, but also because the region of Michigan that it's in, which is kind of southwest Michigan, stretching up from Kalamazoo into the Grand Rapids suburbs, this is a part of the state that has been trending to the left over time. It's why Michigan's 3rd district, which was historically a more Republican-leaning seat, flipped to Democrats in 22, and now they think they might have an opportunity to flip the 4th district right south of it in 2026. And so this is a seat that we currently have rated likely Republican, but I think if it becomes open, this is one that could really come online and could move into a more competitive category. And even if I think Huizinga stays in this seat, if we're looking at the demographic shifts here, particularly around the Grand Rapids area and some of the suburbs and exurbs there, we have really seen these parts of Michigan trend towards Democrats. For example, one place, Holland, Michigan, which is on the shores of Lake Michigan, is a place that has historically been pretty Republican. Republicans won it in the 2012 presidential election, but it has moved to the left by several points over the course of the past 12 years or so. And so this is a race that could become a lot more interesting the closer we get to 2026.
And actually, Erin, I brought a prop in case you need it for any of these House districts. This is my Michigan mitt. So if you need
Amazing.
To identify,
yes.
If we're talking about Lansing, let's talk about Lansing next. Let's talk about Michigan 7, which is right kind of here in the middle.
Michigan 4 is here.
Yeah.
Michigan 3 is here.
And for folks listening at home, if you are just listening and not watching our video, I am holding up my oven mitt, so just so you know. But go ahead, Erin.
Yeah, I should be doing this when I'm describing the geography of the state. So the fourth is here in the southwest corner of Michigan. Now, the competitive districts in Michigan that we have followed in recent years are more in the Detroit suburbs around here, and then in mid-Michigan, which is right in the center of the state around Lansing, the state capital.
Yeah, and that's where Tom Barrett is in our run race in Michigan. That's a straight toss up. Talk a little bit about that race and why Democrats think that they got a good chance at flipping that one this cycle.
Yeah, so Michigan's 7th district, right in the middle of the state, this is the most competitive district in the state. And this is a district that voted for Trump narrowly in 2016, voted for Biden narrowly in 2020, and then voted for Trump narrowly again last November. So it's a true swing state. It has correctly picked the presidential winner in the past 5 presidential elections. There's only 2 other seats in the country that fit into that category. So this is a real bellwether that we always follow closely. So Republicans were able to flip this seat last cycle with Tom Barrett, and he's now a freshman Republican. And I think, you know, Democrats see him as perhaps one of the more formidable Republican incumbents in swing seats, I would say. But by nature of his district, this is going to be a top target for them, and he is going to be very vulnerable next year. And so in this race, we have a couple of Democrats who are taking a look at running here. This seat was previously held by Alyssa Slotkin, who is, of course, now in the Senate. And she really did well in this seat by talking about her background in national security. And so Democrats are hoping to find a candidate in a similar mold next cycle to run against Barrett, who is also a veteran and made that a central part of his campaign last time. And so Democrats will likely have 2 serious candidates in this race. One is Bridget Brink, who is the former ambassador to Ukraine, who actually resigned from her post about a month ago. And then Matt Masdem, who is a retired Navy SEAL who once carried the nuclear football for President Obama, is also gearing up for a run. And so that's going to be an interesting primary. It's going to be an interesting general election. But I do think that regardless of what's happening with some other potential competitive seats in Michigan, the 7th district probably remains the top target for Democrats next year.
Yeah, and we've talked about 2 races that Democrats are hoping to flip in their favor. But there is also a House race that Republicans are hoping to target. That's in Michigan 8. Let's talk a little bit about that and why Republicans think that they maybe have a chance to flip at least one seat in the Wolverine state.
Yeah, so Michigan's 8th district, also in the center of the state.
Right.
It's around
I lost Flint. The mitt, sorry.
It's around Flint, Michigan, the Bay City, the Tri-City area. And this is a district that historically was pretty Democratic leaning. Former Congressman Dan Kildee held it for a while, and he was always a very tough opponent for Republicans, even as this seat was trending to the right, as Trump was doing better and better with a lot of working class voters in this district. And so now that Democrats were able to hold it last cycle with Kristen McDonald Rivett, who put up a pretty impressive overperformance, actually. So Trump won this district by 2 points, the first time he has done that. He lost it in 2016 and 2020. But despite that, Kristen McDonald Rivett, who was a Democratic state senator, was able to win her race by 7 points. And that was in large part because she faced a really flawed Republican opponent in Paul Young, who got attacked for being a quote-unquote California trust fund kid, which obviously was not a great fit for a working-class district where most people are not moving in and out of it, not home to a lot of transplants. But now she is going to be a top target for Republicans next year. I think McDonald Rivett still has the edge, given her overperformance last cycle and the fact that 2026 should be at least a slightly better for Democrats year for Democrats in Michigan than we saw in 2024 when Trump was winning the state. But this is still going to be a top target for Republicans. Republican super PACs have already spent around $800,000 on ads attacking McDonald Rivett. So it's clear from where they're investing their money that they see this as a top pickup opportunity.
And I would just say, you know, there was some speculation already that earlier this year that Kristen McDonald Rivett might run for Senate and that seat would open up. Aaron, does it seem to you like Democrats are doing a little bit better job of keeping sort of their incumbents in these overly, you know, there's some marginal seats, of course, like Angie Craig and things, but, you know, like Jared Golden running again in Maine, like it does sort of seem like they're doing a little bit better job in the most competitive seats.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. To be honest, there really just aren't that many truly competitive open seats at this point. Michigan's 10th district, which we haven't even talked about because there's so much going on in Michigan this cycle, that is the one truly competitive open seat. It's held by Republican John James, who is running for governor, and that one we have rated lean Republican. But the other open seats that we have so far, like Chris Pappas's seat, New Hampshire 1, which is now open because he's running for Senate, Angie Craig's seat, like you mentioned, in Minnesota, these are both seats that we have rated likely Democrat, and we think those are pretty unlikely to flip next year. But yeah, I would say at this point, Democrats have had a little bit more success convincing their swing seat members to stay in their seats.
And Aaron, I love what you were mentioning about sort of the idea of these carpetbaggers being, somebody being labeled a carpetbagger being like the ultimate insult, especially in Michigan. And I will plug our colleague Matthew Klein's piece also from earlier this week, where he looked at a bunch of data. And one of them was by every congressional district, what percentage of the population is from that particular state. And Michigan is like, it stands out for like people are born in Michigan and they stay there. It looks so different than a lot of the other districts, that even some competitive ones from all over the country, where somebody could be from New York and running in Florida, no one cares. In Michigan, it really matters. So check that out too. Jess, you mentioned John James. Do you want to talk a little bit about the governor's race? Because that is going to be in this political earthquake that's going to be happening in Michigan, that's going to be the top of the ticket next year.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the Michigan governor's race is the most fascinating governor's race in the country this cycle. So James is one of many candidates running in former Attorney General Mike Cox, Art Nesbitt in the state legislature. So there's several candidates still running there. But James, I think, is the front runner based on early polling we've seen. It looks like on the Democratic side, the Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, has the edge. She still faces a primary against Garland Gilchrist, the lieutenant governor, who's hoping to sort of marshal together African-American support in that primary. Of course, we know that Democratic primary voters, especially in Michigan, a large portion are Black voters. But what makes this so interesting is the inclusion of a third candidate, Mike Duggan, who is the outgoing mayor of Detroit. Now, he's won as a Democrat before, and he really irked a lot of Democrats when he decided late last year to sort of bypass the primary and declare that he's going to run as an independent. So this has really stoked worries, especially among Democrats, that he could pull off more support from Democrats than he does among Republicans and sort of hand the race to James or another Republican. I mean, what makes Duggan so interesting is that he's an incredibly popular mayor, sort of credited with sort of turning Detroit around. You know, the city was once bankrupt and things, so he's really sort of credited with turning it around. And so much of the vote is going to come not just from Detroit, but from the suburbs in Wayne County. And he's also very popular in these suburban areas, too. Early polling sort of shows him not in the lead. And there was one recent poll that actually showed him pulling almost equally from Republicans and Democrats. I think he could very well have some moderate Republicans that would vote for him. You know, but to me, it's a test of, okay, voters increasingly say they dislike both parties. They don't identify with either party. Well, here is a legitimate independent who could have some real money behind him. And you're given this choice. Listen, I think this is easier to sort of do in a governor's race than a Senate race. And I think, you know, the most recent time we saw this was Oregon. The 2022 race was a three-way race with Betsy Johnson, a state legislator, pouring a lot of money in there. Now she seemed competitive, and then her numbers go down, which we typically see with independents. But, I mean, Duggan doesn't have a statewide base yet, and the polling that I've seen shows that he still has a lot to do to raise his name ID statewide, particularly in Western Michigan. But if he can get the money to do that, you know, again, I go back to the primaries. Republicans and Democrats are going to have pretty nasty primaries on both of their sides until August. Not only just a few weeks later, early voting begins, and Duggan sort of gets to skate through there. I mean, I think we'll certainly see Democratic groups probably attack him, but I think the candidates sort of have to focus on their own primaries. So, to me, can he get the money? I'm really interested to see his most recent fundraising report. It's just a really fascinating, I think, experiment of, okay, you say you're fed up with both parties. Here is someone who is running in the middle, saying, you know, I identify with that. I mean, Democrats are, of course, saying, you know, this is insincere and Republicans will just attack him as a Democrat. But, you know, you do have a very well-known individual trying to do this. So to me, that makes Michigan sort of the most fascinating governor's race I'm watching.
So what I'm hearing really is that we need a lakeside bureau in Michigan for the Cook Political Report for maybe July of next year. Does that sound about right?
That sounds good to me.
I think that sounds great. Yeah. The primary is in August, so we can line it up with that.
I mean, I will say one source I talked with this week, he was on the source was on the beach talking to me from the shores of Lake Michigan. So I was very jealous when we were, you know, having triple digit days here in D.C.
Before we go, we obviously have to do our segment that we do every time that we do Editor's Roundtable, which is, what is the story that I'm obsessed with this week? So let's start with you, Erin. What is the thing that, like, you just can't get off your mind?
So there was a special election primary in Florida this week that featured two siblings running against each other. They were both in the state legislature, so it's not like they're not both without their own political experience. But the sister won. The brother, actually, Randolph Bracey, I was familiar with because he's run for Congress before. But apparently their mom did take sides and endorsed the sister over the brother. So I don't know how you move on from that as a sibling. I fight with my sisters over the teeniest things possible. And so I'm sure that'll be an awkward family situation for a long time.
What I found fascinating in that story, Erin, that you sent around too, like, the brother had actually primaried the prior woman who held the seat, who was the mom's best friend. So I feel like he also kind of did not win points for primarying her best friend and then also running against the sister. So
a lot of drama. I don't know what's going on in Florida.
I can't imagine. Like, did they lobby the mom? Like, did they have, like, individual meetings? Were they, like, showing the polling to the mom, being like, look, I can win? I mean, it's amazing. All right, Jess, go ahead.
I've gone back and forth on something, but this has literally been something that I've been thinking about all day, so I'm going to go with it, is that, okay, the other thing to know about me other than I love politics is that I'm a diehard Tennessee Volunteer fan. And there is the strong possibility that we could have two former Tennessee coaches running for Senate. So I don't know what to do with myself in this situation. with Tommy Tuberville, another former SEC football coach, running now for governor, increasingly coaches running. I also wrote about possibly former Ohio state coach Jim Tressel might run in Ohio governor. In the Ohio governor's race, but Bruce Pearl, the Alabama basketball coach, might run in that primary. He coached at Tennessee first before he had some scandals and recruiting scandals, and then now rehabilitated himself at Auburn. But the one that completely floored me today, which we were on a meeting when this came through and stuff, and like my jaw literally dropped, was that Derek Dooley is now lobbying to be the Republican nominee, the consensus nominee in Georgia. Now, his name, his last name at least, will be familiar to a lot of Georgia voters and Georgia people in Georgia, because his father, Vince Dooley, was the legendary coach of the Georgia Bulldogs. But Dooley coached at Tennessee in what I would say was a very unremarkable era. Losing seasons. We lost to Vanderbilt. We lost to Kentucky for the first time in my life. It was not a good season. He was known for wearing these big orange pants. And again, as a Tennessee fan, I also love that there's also sites that have popped up, like pointing you to like the stuff he said about Tennessee, like in orange and white and different things. And like a clip resurfacing on Twitter saying that, you know, he doesn't pick sides anymore. He doesn't really watch Georgia football. He doesn't pick sides when that happens, which is just the death knell in Georgia politics. So, you know, he wouldn't get elected even in Tennessee because he is despised there. But is this enough? You know, we had a former Georgia football player who was beloved run in that seat, run for Senate, not for this seat specifically. I mean, Bruce Pearl has sort of dabbled in politics. He's been very outspoken on issues with Israel and different things. But Dooley was just like, came out of nowhere. So I'm still processing this. And like, I think it has had some trauma for those games that I watch. And, you know, and he's not known as a big Republican donor and things. So he's close to Kemp, but can he get Trump support? So, you know, I think my head might explode if two former Tennessee coaches run for Senate. So
whatever the through line is in like coaches in the Midwest and the Southeast deciding like, you know, what is next for me, not an $8 million a year deal or whatever to be a coach, but I'm going to go be one of 100 people in the United States Senate. Like, I mean, I appreciate the ambition, if nothing else. The thing that I am obsessed with and maybe just worried about, let's be honest, is the Cook Political Report. I will pull the curtain back a little bit into our office culture, because if you are a reader of the New York Times and or if you are a movie buff, there is the New York Times is releasing their 100 best movies of the 21st century. And they also have the option for you to make your own list of your favorite movies of the 21st century. And so we are, we're doing this at the Cook Political Report and comparing our lists. I think everyone else is way ahead of the deadline, which is Monday. I'm normally the person who cares the most about deadlines at the Cook Political Report. And I am gonna go right up to the wire because I have a high level of anxiety about having a good list because people have very, very good tastes in movies, in addition to many other things. But one of the things that I am obsessed with is that I think every single person, people who have had small children and people who have not, have at least one animated list on there. There's a very heavy Pixar representation. So I might spend my weekend agonizing about Monsters, Inc. versus Inside Out. Like, that's where we are, in addition to everything else happening in the world.
That's where it is. I liked Coco.
I felt left out because I actually didn't include an animated film, but I thought about Ratatouille.
I don't think I've seen your list yet, so okay.
I think I'm the one who sparked this homework assignment, Carrie, so I apologize.
I mean, I'm stressing because I can't remember 10 movies that I've watched in the past, like, few years.
I've also got high recency bias. Like, something I saw last year is going to make the list, and something from 5 years ago, like, I'll totally forget about. But
like one of them, Amelie, that was high on the list, like, for times. I, like, forgot that even came out in the 21st century.
Well, this has been a ton of fun. Thank you, Erin. Thank you, Jess. We got through a lot today. If you're already a subscriber to the Cook Political Report, thank you. If you are not, please consider subscribing today. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe to learn more. All of the stuff we are talking about today and so much more that we couldn't get to, you can read about there. So please, please, please consider signing up. And one more thing, if you are listening on Apple and you like what you hear, please rate and review us. It really helps let other people know about these conversations. Until next time, thank you from all of us here at the Cook Political Report.